had a revelation this week. It was this. I don't think I'm young anymore. I was at the doctor because I've had some issues with my knee. So I was at the doctor's this week, and I woke up 2 weeks ago, and my knee was hurting, which is disconcerting because I didn't do anything to it to hurt my knee. And I wish I even remembered my dreams. It would at least give me a good story if I was like, I was dreaming about fighting a tiger and I hurt my knee, but nothing. It's just hurting. I could hardly walk. And so I went to the doctor, and he said, you know, we're going to go for x-rays. But he's like, it looks like you've got arthritis probably there. You know, there's not a whole lot we can do, essentially. But he did say this. He said, you should probably be on light duties at work. So, right? So, this is me on light duties at work here. Anyway, I hope you understand that I'm working through the pain this morning, just for you, anyway. Well, last week, we looked under the hood of the enemy-making machine, and one of the components that we found is that groups have a propensity, oftentimes out of need or necessity, to create distinctions that help define them as a group. But these distinctions, they often turn into banners, right? Banners, these things that we define ourselves by that differentiate us from others, and it sort of signals who's in, who's out of the group. And banners make us feel safe and secure about our side, what we believe, our people, our place in the world, our history. But what often is happening underneath the hood of the enemy-making machine is that these distinctions, these banners, are manufacturing enemies. And so what I want to do this week is I want to concentrate on how collectively, as a church, as groups, we can avoid this pitfall. And later in the series, I want to look at what this might look like individually, but this is more about how can churches engage in conflict without falling into the enemy-making machine? How do churches avoid bannerism and the propensity we have to make enemies? And the fascinating thing to me is that when you come to the Gospels, understanding the way banners and conflict work, you start to notice that Jesus was incessantly placed in the middle of conflicts. He's relentlessly faced with these loaded questions about sides. And it means to me, by the way, that Jesus understands what it's like to live in polarized times, in a polarized climate. And so for today, what I want to do is I want to simply showcase for you three stories from the Gospels where Jesus encounters banners, conflicts, division, side-making, and how he disrupts all of it. And I think there's something very instructive for churches here in these stories, so I want to focus on that. The first story is a story of Jesus breaking what seems like a rather petty law. Now, I don't know if all of you heard the big news this week, big news coming out of Canada, and it's this. Twiggy, the water skiing squirrel, has been banned from Canada. It's unbelievable. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen Twiggy, but you got to look him up when you get home. This squirrel, he water skis. It's amazing. And he goes to boat shows, and he water skis for people, and it's great. But this week, the minister of something reminded the boat shows, sorry, this is illegal. You're not allowed to own a squirrel as a pet in Canada. Which, I got to be honest, seems absolutely absurd to me, because do you know what you can own as a pet? A tiger. You can own a tiger in Canada as a pet, but you can't own a squirrel. And quite frankly, I hate squirrels. If they're going to be around, they might as well be water skiing for us, right? So, but it's this crazy, weird law. You can own lots of exotic animals. You can own a python, but you can't own a squirrel. And this ridiculous law reminded me of what Jesus is about to run into here. Because you have to remember, leading up to this story, for the Hebrew people, they were freed from slavery and bondage in Egypt. And so for them, practicing the Sabbath, one day a week of complete rest, this was a Hebrew distinction. It was a fundamental part of their identity. For them, it was like, we are people who rest from work because we know working all the time is a sign of slavery. We know humans were not created machines. We know that identity can't be found in producing or achieving. So we rest because work does not define us. It does not enslave us. And so this is an important part of our identity. This is a big deal to the Hebrew people. And it starts as a good and necessary distinction. But over time, the Sabbath becomes a banner. So meshed in Hebrew identity, it becomes extreme. They start dissecting, what does it mean to work? And it starts getting down to these crazy things. Well, you can't travel so far because to walk more than, you know, say your 10,000 steps a day, that would require work. So you can only go so far. You can't heal on the Sabbath day. You can't pick food. There's all these rules that pop up that try to sort of make it clear what working is and isn't. And then this happens. Jesus and his followers, they're wandering through some grain fields on the Sabbath, and they find themselves hungry. And so they're wandering through the grain fields, and they start picking and eating some heads of grain, and naturally, because it's a story, they get caught. And it sparks a controversy. You have violated Hebrew identity. You've violated what makes us distinct. Which side are you on? I mean, you have to sort of imagine this. It doesn't sound like a big deal to us. I suppose it would be like somebody from PETA getting caught eating meat. Like, this is, you've fundamentally violated who you are. And that's what's happening to Jesus here. It's not good. And notice how Jesus responds in the tactics at play here. Jesus answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on the Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath and yet are innocent? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." As if that wasn't enough, it continues on. So going on from that place, he went into their synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there, and they were looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus. So they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "If any of you has a sheep and falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath." I think Jesus reveals some interesting tactics here in dealing with the enemy-making machine. I think it's telling, it's instructive. So to start, in Jesus' case here, he doesn't start by defending himself against the accusations. And I find that interesting. It's not, "Hey, I can pick grain if I want to. I'll do whatever I want to." He doesn't get defensive. And I think it's subtle, but again, telling. If Jesus gets defensive here, it would make Jesus a participant in the enemy-making machine. Being defensive always fires up the energy of the enemy-making machine. It stokes flames. It gives it more energy. I don't know about you, but I get defensive about things. It makes it worse, though. Chris and I were talking a while ago. She brought up that the fact that I do most of the driving might be a sign of residual patriarchy. I got to tell you, I got a little testy. I got a little defensive, because the reality is, the reason I do most of the driving is because she's awful. There's nothing to do with patriarchy. She just happens to be a bad driver. We have a standard. Sometimes she's on the 401 in third gear. None of you drive standard, do you? You don't know what that does to your head, because it's like, the things are high, and it's like, and I got testy, I got defensive, and yet it's absurd. It could have been an interesting conversation. I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean? I'm just a good driver. I get defensive, and then it moves into this thing, and what I found about myself is I get defensive, but getting defensive only makes things worse in the enemy-making machine. It just feeds and re-entrenches people in their own side. And I find it very interesting, of all the conflicts Jesus finds himself in, he never gets defensive. Never reacts that way. Instead, what Jesus does is this: he gets curious. Notice what he does. He starts by asking questions, and then he tells stories, and then a space is opened up, and he presents a new reality. He presents a space beyond enemies, a new sacred reality. And I think when you look at his stories, these tactics are not random. They're intentional. He starts asking questions that lead to stories. And by asking questions, by telling stories, he ensures that any given conflict doesn't remain abstract. Tell stories, real people. Remember David? Remember the priests? It's interesting to me that these questions and stories and the way it plays out, they expose where a banner or a distinctive doesn't apply or contradicts itself. And within those exceptions, those contradictions, Jesus opens up a space for a new reality to emerge. And in this space, what Jesus presents is this idea that bannerism is always trumped by mercy. And he opens this space beyond conflict. And in this sacred space, what he reveals is banners must always surrender to mercy, compassion, kindness, goodness. And it's a great reminder, whatever banners or distinctions we carry as a group or individual, those must surrender to Jesus' call for mercy, compassion, kindness, goodness. I mean, this is what Paul's getting at in 1 Corinthians 13, right? His famous chapter where he talks about, you can do the greatest things in the world, but if you don't do it without love, you're but a noisy gong symbol. Love. These things always trump every banner, whatever distinctions we hold, whatever things we hold that are a part of our identity, they always must surrender to mercy, compassion, kindness, goodness. And so I find something instructive here. Doesn't get defensive, he gets curious, asks questions, tells stories, presents an alternative that isn't a compromise, it's a new possibility. Second story, this one's good. The Pharisees went out and they laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity, that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Again, these things can come to us as sort of abstract or like ideas that we don't care about. Essentially, what they're doing is this. They've imagined trapping a politician and saying, what do you think about abortion? Whoa. This is one of these moments where it's like, wow, this is a hot button issue for the Hebrew people, and they're putting him on the spot. What are you going to do? And so the question, of course, there's something happening here. The question would answer for these people once and for all. The way he answers this is going to define for us. It will showcase for us exactly what side Jesus is on. Because paying the imperial taxes to Caesar was a dividing question. What does Jesus do? He understands that these types of questions are always a trap. These types of questions are often about nailing people down, figuring out, okay, what side are you on? Figuring out if they're the enemy or not. Jesus won't play that game. Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? You ever feel that way culturally today? Some loaded question, like, why do I feel like I'm about to be trapped? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose image is this? Questions again. Whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and went away. What's intriguing to me here is this, is Jesus refuses to engage conflict on terms dictated to him. He's given a choice. Which is it, Jesus, one or the other? Is it right or wrong? Jesus is like, I'm not playing the game by the rules you've handed to me. That would put me right into the enemy-making machine. I think it's, again, brilliant and instructive. He's handed terms. Here's the terms of the conflict. And he simply refuses. No, I'm not entering that on those terms. And what I find interesting about Jesus throughout the Gospels is this. Jesus refuses to make enemies, and yet His very presence in the way he engages conflict reveals enemies. What do I mean by that? When I look at Jesus in the Gospels, he never creates enemies. He disrupts the enemy-making machine, but by doing so, he reveals those kinds of people who love being enemies. He just exposes them by refusing to play the game. No. You kind of people love, you just love looking for an enemy, don't you? Your questions are but a ruse. And so by refusing to engage the question on their terms, he exposes some people love being enemies. Some people love making enemies. It's a sickness. And yet, I think I might be one of those people. I don't know about you, but I got caught. My goodness. I watched the State of the Union address this week. Whew! Are we not entertained? I was entertained. My goodness. It was like tension. You could cut it with a knife. I was like, this would be good. I got my popcorn. Kristen wasn't interested. Nobody wanted to watch with me. But I'm like, wow. Up goes Donald. Snubs the handshake. I'm like, whoo, 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 whoo. Got my popcorn like, this is getting tense. And then right at the end, right? Old Nancy. I'm like, oh, she just ripped up his speech. I'm like trying to text friends, like, are you guys seeing this? This is amazing. I'm like, oh, I love it. Oh. I have to admit, I was kind of entertained by the spectacle of it all. I feel like I'm that kind of person. I like enemies. I really like winning. Like, I got this neighbor. My goodness, he's something. You have a neighbor and they're just like great at everything. This guy, he went too far one night. Neighbor, he's tall, he's very handsome. He's got a beard that it's a beautiful beard. And he's good at everything, but this one night, he comes out and he's playing banjo on a unicycle. Yeah, we're at an outdoor party and he's playing banjo on his unicycle and I'm like, really? Playing banjo is one thing, unicycle, that's great. Together, it's too much goodness for me. So I laid a trap for him. Started talking about exercise, and I was like, well, you know, in grade two, I won the 100-meter dash, set a school record. And you know, guys like these who are great like him, you know they can't resist this stuff. Oh, you're fast. Well, I said it would surprise you, but over short distances, I'm surprisingly quick. And sure enough, before you know it, he and I, 100-meter race, that night, down. I'm like, all right, banjo boy, here we go. I can't even tell you how bad I schooled him, and I loved it. I was able to cross the line with my arms like this. It was so great. I really am quick over short distances, and I know what some of you are thinking. You could beat me. If it weren't for the knee injury, I would take you up. It's just, I can't. Or, I'm sure some of you know, you've probably been thinking about this yourself, but if there's one person in this community we all know who's a little too arrogant, it's Brian on the slides there. You know, and this has concerned my heart. You kind of took the wind out of my sails there, Brian. And yet, Brian, you have proven my point. You see, it's concerned me pastorally, these antics of his. And so he always brags about how good he is at games. I had him over one night, beat him 3 times at Settlers of Catan. He now has to call me Lord of Catan. That's who I am. And the reason that I told this story, Brian, is because I wanted to showcase for you how the enemy-making machine works. And Brian has fallen right into my trap, because instead of being like Jesus and non-defensive, he reacted the way I thought he would. So pray for Brian. But yeah, am I the only one? Like, there's these moments with people or with other groups who are like, I love winning. I kind of like being the enemy. Kind of feed on that, right? And you know, in you know, funny little things, it's fine, but there's a lot of situations in life where we sort of just, oh, it really scratches an itch to be the enemy. There's some kinds of people where you're like, I kind of like that those kinds of people hate me. Kind of like that feeling. And I love that what Jesus does here is he's just like exposes people. Like, you so clearly just love being an enemy. You love making enemies. And that's a weird thing. I mean, it's some great reflection questions for us. Do you like being an enemy? An enemy? A villain? Do you like being contrarian? Do you enjoy feeling superior to others? Jesus, it's fascinating to me, he refuses all of this. He refuses to engage a conflict on the terms given to him and exposes that for some of us in our hearts, there's actually a little bit of a glee we get from being enemies and making enemies. Third story, and this one is just the story par excellence. John 8, many of you are familiar with it. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him. He sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such woman. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his fingers. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And that, at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." This really highlights for me how Jesus deals with the enemy-making machine. It's textbook. And so a woman is caught in adultery and she's placed before this mob. She's been made into an object. She's the enemy. She's become the fuel for the enemy-making machine, and the crowd is now directing their collective wrath towards her. This is like 2 weeks ago, we talked about Memories Pizza. A mob's entire fury is now aimed at one single person. It's like this tornado cloud has touched down on this woman. She's the next battleground in the culture wars of the day. And notice how depersonalized this is for the mob. She stands before the mob, and they ask questions of Jesus as if she's not even in the room. It's like she doesn't exist. She doesn't count as a human being. They've made her into this depersonalized object, just like all of our cultural battles do. Who cares about the person? What side are you on? And in this moment, the mob, they've distanced themselves from her, and they're aiming this perverse glee and wrath and hatred directly at her. And in the midst of this spectacle, they ask Jesus, "So what should we do? Law says to stone her." And so this belief system becomes a banner. The Hebrew law, as it was intended, Jesus, of course, says it's summed up by what? Love God, love your neighbor. And so the law, what it's become is this banner, this distinctive. And it started out as a good and necessary thing, but now it's simply used to pit one group against another without any regard for mercy, compassion, kindness, goodness. It's nothing more than an empty symbol for them. So there's this perverse glee on display. It's like, look at this pathetic woman. She can't live up to our standards. We've exposed her for what she is. They're all the signs of the enemy-making machine at work. The machine is in high gear. There's going to be blood. A life is about to be destroyed. And right in the middle of it, Jesus is asked to enter the fray. Speak into the enemy-making machine, Jesus. What side are you on? It's time to choose. Quit sitting on the fence. What side are you on? Tell us. Jesus is just silent. Just sitting there, completely silent. And then he distracts the mob. And I love that the story doesn't tell us what he wrote, because it's this curiosity. He's silent, and then he distracts. And this kind of tactic, silence, then distraction, Jesus uses it repeatedly throughout the Gospels. It's fascinating when you find Jesus caught in a conflict with a banner, faced with a decision, what side are you on? Silence. Distraction. Because he again refuses to enter the conflict on the terms provided to him. He won't do it. And it's interesting because the silence and distraction alone is enough to drain some of the violent energy at work. In the face of a mob and the energy of violence going on there, just silence and distraction is enough to break some of it. But then he does something even more shocking. He stands up and says, "Sure, let's go for it. Let's stone her." And we'll start with those of you who have no sin. It's like, you're right, technically we got a problem here. So, yep, let's follow the law. Here's a stone. Who's going to be first? Those without sin. And I love that the story says that the older ones walked away first. The wisdom of age to say, "Oh, crap, I'm caught." And young bucks like, "Well, I don't know, me, And they walk away. And it's fascinating to me because there's a tactic going on here. David Fitch says this, it's again a tactic. Here the perverse enjoyment at work in the Pharisees who want to stone the woman is exposed. The ones ready to stone the woman suddenly see themselves in the absurdity of the moment. The antagonism is broken and the violence flitters away as one by one the accusers disperse. The woman is left in the presence of Jesus, cleared of all strife and violence and anger. In areas of conflict, when the enemy-making machine is at work, Jesus' tactics, not being defensive, silence, diversion, questions, stories, all of this meant to draw out and expose the perverse glee we have at conflict. The perverse glee we have over feeling of enemies being made. And what Jesus does in this moment by using these tactics is he lets people see themselves. It's like he holds up a mirror. Look at you. Look at who you are. Look at what you've become. You know, it's one of those things that I'd love to do at an OHL hockey game. It always amazes me. I've got caught in myself. You go to these OHL hockey games and two, like, 17-year-olds will start fighting. And what does the crowd do? Yes! Yes! Get them! And I'd love to just have a mirror and be like, if this was random two 17-year-olds at high school, would you be so enthralled then? Jesus goes, look at you. Look at you guys. Just holds a mirror. Simply by being silent, not defensive, asking good questions. Lets them see themselves for who they are. You know, I got a snoring problem, apparently. And I got a mask that I wear. It's called a CPAP machine. It makes it so I don't snore. But what tends to happen is this. I go to bed, I put on the mask, and then at some point in the night, I wake up and open my eyes and realize there's a mask on me, and I freak out because it feels like someone's trying to... So I rip it off and throw it and then go back to sleep. And then I'm gently woken up by Kristen, who says, "Put on your mask, because you're keeping everybody up," and then I'm like, "Get out of here." It's you're sleeping. You can't be held accountable, can you, for the things you say and do. But one night, because this happens frequently, Kristen decided to record me snoring. And I've left that at home. But when she showed me the video, I looked hideous. The noise I made, it sounds like a pig being sacrificed. It's just like, and then it'll go quiet. And she's like, you never know if it's going to be 3 seconds or 10 seconds. But it's just like this noise. I can't deal with it. But looking at myself on camera, snoring like that, I was just like, I'm hideous. Look away. It's awful. Now I get it. I would wake me up too. It's awful. But sometimes you have to see yourself before you realize how bad things are. And this is what Jesus is doing by instead of getting defensive or wading into the conflict, simply through questions, silence, just shows them themselves. And seeing themselves, I go, my goodness, what have we become? What would it be like to be exposed for one fault and be at the hands of an angry mob? And it's only after this happens, it's only after the woman is released from the violence and hate and antagonism of the enemy-making machine, that Jesus is then able to say, once the crowd and anger is dispersed, you're forgiven. Now choose the way of sin no longer. And this is so key to me. Jesus only does healing work after she's been freed from the enemy-making machine. Because within the enemy-making machine, there's never any healing. No one changes when they're in the midst of the enemy-making machine. All it does is compound hurts and re-entrench people in their position. It makes them defensive over and over again. And I think what God understands is this: for minds and hearts to change, Jesus has to do his kingdom work where outside of anger and wrath and the energy of the enemy-making machine. And so it's only after she's freed from that that she's able to be given new direction. I believe this is a parable for the church. This is what we're called to be the kind of presence community that unwinds the anger and antagonism of cultural conflicts. This is, we're not going to get defensive, but we're also not going to enter conflict on the terms offered to us. I think that's the key to me, is Jesus always sidesteps the terms. No, we're not going to enter on that. We're not going to start there. And I think for me, it's a big call to us as a church. Let us make fewer banners, fewer distinctions. Instead, like Jesus, can we simply learn to be present to one another, enter into community with one another without being defensive? We must learn to be curious, ask questions, and if those questions don't work, learn to ask better questions. Instead of coming to one another entrenched in sides, come to one another in genuine curiosity. And when things get heated, we have to learn the art of being silent, asking questions, telling stories, never leaving it in the abstract, real stories of people. I mean, this is precisely what happens in the New Testament. They're arguing about Gentiles. Should they be in? The church is, they got this big argument going on. And then something happens with a man named Cornelius. And Peter comes to the church who's rife with conflict and tension. And he says, let me tell you a story about a man I know named Cornelius. And God is at work in his life. And suddenly the conflict dissolves. Because we can get so entrenched in our ideologies and our sides. But when it's a story of a real person, things change. And so I wish and I hope and I want to be catalyst for being a community where we tell stories of God at work, where we see new space being opened up, stories of places beyond enemies. And if we need to, take in insults, remain undefensive, perhaps allow the perverse glee within conflict to be exposed, because it's only after the machine is exposed and dissipated that space is made for Jesus to work. And I think this is what it means to move beyond the enemy-making machine. Like Jesus' presence, we don't get defensive, but we unwind. And this is the liberation to me of the Jesus path. In Jesus, we're released from the enemy-making machine. We don't have to play by the terms given to us. There's a new space available outside the angry machine. And in that, Jesus is creating space, I think, for the healing of the world, for individuals and communities. I'm going to ask the band to come and close with a song that many of us know and love, Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. And hope this will perhaps just give us some reflection time, a moment to allow these ideas to sink in. But I think this is the challenge for us as a community. Can this church be Jesus' presence? Can we become a reconciling presence in a world full of strife around us? Can we be that in our circle of space, wherever that is? Maybe it's at work, maybe it's at the hockey rink, maybe it's in your neighborhood, online, at a bar, with friends, family, whatever. But can we collectively be Jesus, who, when given a banner of conflict, disrupts the enemy-making machine and provides a space beyond enemies? Band?